You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll talk to an Eau Claire guitar maker who's been building and repairing guitars and ukuleles for decades.
First, legendary boxer, activist, and humanitarian Muhammad Ali died last Friday at the age of 74. The tributes have been pouring in for the man who once proclaimed himself as the greatest. Based on the response, it would be easy to think that Ali was a universally loved hero all his life.
But our next guest says that white America was reluctant to embrace the most loquacious black man in sports and only fully did so after Ali was largely stripped of his voice due to Parkinson's disease. He also says that describing Ali or any black celebrity who passes away as someone who transcends race essentially washes off the celebrity's blackness and the influence it had.
Lawrence Ross joins us now. He's a writer, lecturer, and author. His latest book is called Blackball, The Black and White Politics of Race on America's Campuses. He recently wrote two pieces about Muhammad Ali and race on the root. Lawrence, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Before we dig into the specifics, what was your response when you heard that Muhammad Ali had passed?
Well, it's one of those things where that, you know, intellectually you think to yourself it's going to happen at some point in time, particularly because he's been sick for so long. But then it felt like the end of an era. It's like, you know, whenever you have someone who's a giant who passes away, it's always more than just the actual person. It's kind of like the end of an era of a stage in life, I guess would be the best way to say it, in terms of someone who's going to, you know, who takes away a lot of history as they pass away. So it was really, really to the heart. It really hurts you to your gut because he represented much more than just himself. He represented a lot, particularly in the African-American community.
And you write about him in the last decade, maybe two decades. Muhammad Ali did become this sort of universally loved figure, not just among certain communities, but across the board. But was this something that we forget maybe was not always the case during his career?
Yeah, one of the reasons why I even wrote the piece for The Root, actually both of those pieces for The Root, is because what was kind of percolating through the African-American community zeitgeist was this notion that, Americans love to rewrite history, and we'd like to make it as pleasant as possible so everyone, loves everyone, you know, when they die. And that's fine as a tribute, but it's disingenuous. And what, one of the things that we forget is we never really actually, you know, go to the true starting point of where famous people actually began, particularly for African Americans. And it wasn't universal at all in terms of white America embracing Muhammad Ali when he first came up, particularly in 1964. In fact, it wasn't to be really historically accurate. African Americans weren't universally embracing of Muhammad Ali. But there were real reasons that can't be skipped over due to the fact of how and why he got to a place of real prominence, but began with a foundation in 1964, starting with his changing his name and then going into the Nation of Islam and its association with Malcolm X. Too often what happens is that we skip ahead and we decide we're going to create a mythological beginning for the person that we all want to embrace, and say from that point on is where I've always loved him, without actually going back to the point in time that it actually makes you question whether or not you actually do love all parts of the man.
What do you think is important that we remember about the difficult parts of Muhammad Ali, or the parts that were more controversial when he was speaking up and had the full use of his voice?
I think one of the things that we should really, really, truly understand is that Muhammad Ali was a reflection of an African American society that was really finding its voice at the exact same time, and one of those particular elements was the idea that African of kind of like the shackles came with kind of having to modulate your in terms of determining who and what you were going to be in America. And so Muhammad Ali was the very first, one of the first, to actually say, no, I'm not going to be named. I'm going to be by Cassius Clay. I'm going to change my name to Muhammad Ali. And why did I do that? It's not simply just as a name change. I'm shedding off a name that I think reflects something that does not belong to me. I'm going to change my religion to Islam. All those things are not just in terms of just his own personal experience, but it's a reflection of African America actually deciding that in this civil rights era, we're shedding off this Jim Crow era. We're going to be free. We're not going to be second-class citizens. We're going to speak our mind. And you see that within the civil rights movement with Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael, and even going on later on with Martin Luther King, speaking beyond just the civil rights movement, but also talking about the Vietnam War. And so you see the African American community finding itself, finding its adulthood, but also having to live in the shackles of white supremacy in the country and systemic racism.
We found a clip of what you're getting at here of Muhammad Ali talking to students in 1967. He didn't go to war. He refused to go. And here he is explaining this to a group of students.
I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now right here fighting you. If I'm going to die, you my enemy. My enemy is a white people, not Viet Cong or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
Now, that's a voice and saying something that you can hear the crowd, the students around him, the energy going up, because what he's saying is confrontational. He's saying, you're the enemy. The white people are the enemy. I'm not going to go to Vietnam and fight someone who's not my enemy.
It's the selective memory that we have when we talk about a person like Muhammad Ali, because what he's trying to say is that, yes, you know, in terms of the macro, in terms of particularly in the late 1960s, where you have pretty much, although it's a multiracial, you would say led by a lot of white college students in terms of the Vietnam War protests in 67, 68 or so, that's on the macro for those white students. But what Muhammad Ali is telling them is that, wait, yes, I may be on your side, but I'm also indicting you in terms of me being a second-class citizen and what happens in this country. And too often what happens is when we talk about history and we do a retrospective, that part gets erased. That part gets erased because that's the difficult part. That's the difficult part, particularly for white Americans, to actually look on and say, well, did we actually take responsibility for what he was actually saying? Did we actually solve those problems that he was actually saying? And the answer would obviously be no. And when the answer is no, that means that we can't just simply just pour all our adulation into, you know, to Muhammad Ali and say, well, he transcended, you know, what was going on. And, you know, I loved everything, because we didn't really take a lot of action to actually deal with the problems that Muhammad Ali was actually articulating. We just picked and chose by saying, well, we really do like the fact that he stood up against the war, which was a courageous act. But he also had words behind why he was doing that.
You can hear that he's not really interested in being liked at that point, of being any sort of ambassador for anything. He's sharing his voice and his ideas, even if they're controversial at the time. And when do you think we sort of lost that thread of that part of Muhammad Ali and who he was?
Well, one of the things I think happened is that, you know, like all natural athletes, when the stage actually begins to, you know, move away from them being an athlete, typically they have lesser voice. I mean, that's not unusual to Muhammad Ali. But Muhammad Ali also had the affliction of Parkinson's. And so the more he actually became afflicted neurologically, one of the things that happened is that people could project upon him what they actually thought and saw him. And I say in my article on The Root, that 1996 was kind of like the epitome of it. We see a giant, which we can all acknowledge as being a giant in athletics, and we can see as a giant, you know, within, you know, in humanitarian. But we see a person who is afflicted by Parkinson's, you know, lighting the torch. But right at that point in time, what happens is that suddenly everyone, regardless of their you know, their political stripe or whether or not they agree with the things that Muhammad Ali believed in, it becomes almost, and I hate this term usually, but it kind of fits. It almost becomes politically correct to actually say that Muhammad Ali is their personal hero. But if you dig deeper into, you know, what Muhammad Ali really believed in terms of the type of equality he actually believed in, it would be completely different than what people who say that they believe him to be a hero, what they actually believe. And so it becomes very disingenuous, and he becomes a very convenient figure to project his whatever people's beliefs of who and what he was, he becomes a very convenient figure. It reminds me, not a direct analogy, but it reminds me of how when Robert E. Lee died, and in the South, they built thousands of monuments to Robert E. Lee. And what they were able to do is this ivory statue, they would basically, people in the South and ex-Confederates, they would project upon Robert E. Lee all these values and ideas of who and what he was, which didn't necessarily have to be to correlate to the history. It just basically talked more about the people and what they wanted. And for Muhammad Ali actually became, a lot of times for white America, this kind of this place where they could kind of say, well, we actually like him, you know, but we don't want to delve deeper into, you know, the things, the real things that he was talking about when he actually could say, when he actually had a voice. They don't really want to delve into those things, and those are the hard things to deal into. And African Americans, on the other hand, remember everything that he said, and at the same time are saying, you know, these are some of the same issues that we're dealing with in 2016, the same things that he said in 1967.
Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Lawrence Ross is a writer, lecturer, and author, and he joined us to talk about Muhammad Ali and race. He's been writing about that for The Root. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we meet an Eau Claire luthier who's been making guitars and ukuleles for over four decades.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Some people make art using paint. Others draw. Artist Stick Vega uses gunpowder to create pop art. I went to visit him in his studio, known as the Blast Factory, to learn how he decided to light his work on fire.
Studying mathematics, I think there's a certain creativity and imagination that comes with complex numbers. So mathematics to a business career, and then into transitioning to find some peace in my head, starting to paint with acrylics in the 90s. And then into this transformation and explosion into gunpowder. It started. I was on a business trip in China and was traveling between Beijing, Nanjing, and Shanghai, and I saw the work of Cai Gao Chang, who's a world-renowned contemporary Chinese painter, and he's on a much grander scale, much more of a pyromaniac than I am. I mean, he does these massive installations and huge explosions and all those things. But again, following up on that, I had been doing some painting. I thought this might be a cool technique to try. So I got his book, got a couple of his different books, read through his process, used Google. So it started from that, and then in good do-it-yourself form, you know, going out and trying it. First one we did, I ordered the base parts, potassium, nitrate, sulfur, and charcoal, the base core pieces to make gunpowder. So I, of course, invited a number of friends over. I didn't know what image I should do first, and my nickname is Stick. It's been Stick for a long time. And I said, well, I'll do a stick man figure. So I had a board, basically poured gunpowder into a stick figure on this board. And then I ran the fuse back 15 feet or 20 feet, and we were all ready to light up and to see what would happen. And I was just about to light the fuse, and I'm thinking, when I light the fuse, this is the moment of pure art. As that fuse begins to burn towards its artistic destination, there is a uncertainty. You don't know what's going to happen, and so there's this anticipation as the fuse burns its way towards the board. Little did I know, at that point, there are hundreds of types of fuses, and they burn at all sorts of different speeds. Light the fuse, and it was a fuse that burned 20 feet per second. It went very quickly to the panel, and kaboom, there was a large, what looked like a mini mushroom cloud, climbed up over the neighborhood here. And at that point, I said, I'm hooked. This is now the coolest thing that I could possibly be doing. So here we go. There it is. Texture that comes from the burn, especially when I'm using papers or some of the more moderate density boards, that the texture and the burn and the parts that come off from that is really something you can't achieve in painting at all. So there's some looks and feels that you can't achieve. 5 or 6 years ago, my mission crystallized into the more gunpowder I use, the less there'll be for killing people. So I try to use a lot of gunpowder. That's what drives me every morning. I get up and every morning I say I'm going to find a way to do something with gunpowder that makes the world a better place.
That was gunpowder artist Stick Vega. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and find us on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Another Wisconsin artist, our next guest, has been making guitars for over 40 years. His instruments are played by such nationally acclaimed musicians as Willie Porter and Bon Iver's Justin Vernon.
We can hear one of his acoustic guitars on Bon Iver's Grammy-winning self-titled album. Here's a taste of that guitar on the song Holocene. Gordy Bischoff is a master guitar maker and the owner of Bischoff Guitars in Eau Claire. Gordy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, when did it first hit you or occur to you that you wanted to make guitars?
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's a bit of a journey. I was interested in music all my life. My father was a band director. I pursued a little bit of interest in maybe teaching and performing when I was younger. It didn't seem to work out for me, but eventually I came to the realization that I also liked things technically involved and found a way to use my interest in music and build and repair musical stringed instruments.
You make your guitars by hand. What is the difference when you make it with your own two hands versus something that's more mass-produced?
Well, heart and soul, I think, for anyone who has seen a piece of handmade pottery as opposed to a bowl that was made in a commercial way, you can see that there's heart and soul to it. And I guess I'd like to believe that my instruments have that sort of an aesthetic that you don't get in commercially made instruments.
Now, talk to us about the material, the wood that a guitar is made of. How much of a difference does it make to the sound and the feel of a guitar, what those original materials are?
Well, there are more woods that are being incorporated. Well, in my career in the past 40 years, it was fairly simple rosewood for back and sides, mahogany for necks. Sometimes mahogany was also used for the back and sides. And almost all stringed instruments have some kind of like a spruce or a cedar for a top. That's very common. There are more exotic woods that are being used these days. But part of it is strength and weight, so there's engineering. But in essence, what you're trying to make is a musical air pump, and so you need to find the wood that's going to make that happen.
Do you have a favorite sound that you're known for? You know, like a violin might have a warmer sound or a clearer sound. What is your sound?
Well, interesting question. I guess I like to go for something that I would call balanced. There are some instruments that focus on bass tones. Some like more projection, so treble, higher end sound. I like to try to find some kind of balance between the two. And for me, that works in my own, when I play myself, and my customers seem to like that as well.
I understand you also make ukuleles, and you're a founder and a card-carrying member of the Ukulele Club of Eau Claire. Can you talk about ukulele making versus guitars?
Oh, my goodness. You found out my
dark secret.
My new passion. Well, it's a funny thing. I had a delay in the shop. I guess it's been about 6-7 years ago. Some wood that wasn't working out, and I had to replace it, and it was going to be some lost shop time. And I was looking for a little project I thought I could do to fill some space and time. And it dawned on me that I had small pieces of wood left over from guitars. And I found some information. I went out and started making them, and boy, did I get bitten by the bug.
What do you like about making ukuleles?
Well, I think in this particular case, it's as much playing the ukulele that drove the making. Obviously, I had to make it first. But as a musician or interested in music all my life, I kind of found a new resurgence, a new interest in playing. And so so that kind of became my passion. And then if you talk to other guitar builders, after you make the first one, you're already thinking about how you're going to improve the next one. And, of course, that was, even though I had many years of building behind me when I made my first ukulele, which was, it's only 6 years ago for that, I was immediately driven to make a second and then a third and then a fourth and then a fifth, just because I kept having more ideas on how I could improve the sound that I had in my head that I wanted to achieve.
I'm hearing you say that ukuleles are addictive.
Wow, can we say that publicly? I'm pretty sure that goes for me. Yeah, I have a club here. We meet once a month. We go out and play for community events, fundraisers for like the local wildlife sanctuary. We're going to play for an art fair this coming Friday in Chippewa Falls. And everyone involved in it they all bring joy and passion, and it's pretty fun.
Gordy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the interest.
Gordy Bischoff is a master guitar maker and the owner of Bischoff Guitars in Eau Claire.
Coming up, a new film released this weekend is causing an uproar among disability activists. We'll learn more about that and how people with disabilities are represented in pop culture in just a few minutes. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Who's gonna steal the show? You know, baby, it's the guitar man. He can make you love. He can make you cry. He will bring you down and he'll get you high. Something keeps him going miles and miles a day to find another place.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up after 7 on this week's Reveal, take a trip to lawless lands. From parts of Africa to places in Oregon and Texas, Reveal takes a look at what happens in the absence of government and finds out who or what comes in to fill that void. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, the film Me Before You opened third this week at the box office. It follows the character Louisa, played by Amelia Clark, who's hired as a caregiver to Will Traynor, played by Sam Claflin. Will's paralyzed following an accident.
But disability activists took issue with a major plot point of the film. A spoiler here, if you're planning on watching it, Will's desire to commit suicide with the help of a physician because he doesn't want to live as a person with disabilities. We want to hear from you. How do you think people with disabilities are portrayed in film? How should they be portrayed in popular culture? Do you take issue with the representation of people with disabilities in movies and in the media? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now to talk about how people with disabilities are portrayed in films and the media is Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi. She's the president of the disability rights group Respectability. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the film adaptation of the novel Me Before You. This just came out this weekend. Here's a clip from the trailer.
I promised my parents 6 months and that's what I've given them.
But that was before me.
I want him to live, but only if he wants to live.
We can't can't just let this happen.
You can't change who people are.
I mean, what can you do?
You love them. And if you hurt
me, I don't want you to miss all the things that someone else could give you.
Clip there from Me Before You. It just came out. And Jennifer, what are some of the issues that you and other groups are having with this film?
Well, first of all, we believe that culture is so very important in defining how people see and feel about issues. And how people see and feel about issues impacts how they act about issues. And when people see a glorified way of dealing with disability by saying, hey, somebody should not live, it is an absolutely abhorrent portrayal. I mean, it's not, you know, it's a movie, it's fiction, it's not as bad as, you know, Hitler. I mean, Hitler, when he, during the Holocaust, literally said that he had laws saying that people with disabilities don't deserve, you know, sort of the food that we give them, that they're a burden on society and that they should go away. And he actively, intentionally killed more than 270,000 individuals with disabilities. And this film is, you know, not at the Hitler level, but it is a cultural film that Americans are watching that fundamentally says that lives are not living, worth living, do not deserve to live if you have a disability. And the fact is that in America today, one in every five people has a disability. Now, the disability may not be as involved as the one in this film because it may be a person has autism or Down syndrome or is blind or is deaf, and it didn't come about all of a sudden. You know, people who have an accident and then have a spinal cord injury or they, you know, develop something where they have very significant mobility issues, it's a huge transition to make. That first year, no doubt about it, is incredibly difficult. But who's to say what's valuable in a life? And certainly Stephen Hawking, who, you know, has very significant mobility issues, is still unlocking the secrets of the universe. So we're
deeply concerned. You're saying that this is a film that portrays an angle of disability that does real harm, that it's not just entertainment that you can shrug off as being something that you just see and forget, that this has the potential to really hurt people.
It absolutely does. And what we see is that people with disabilities, there's so much of a stigma around disability that frequently people do not want to, quote unquote, come out of the closet about their disability. I mean, there's a number of different kinds. I mean, there's people who have bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or depression, and they don't want anybody to know that they have a mental health disability. They try and hide it. They don't seek the supports that they need. You see in Wisconsin that there are children who have learning disabilities in school, whether it's dyslexia or dysgraphia or other disabilities, that don't get the diagnosis and the early intervention that they need so that they can succeed in school, and then they fail to graduate high school, and pretty soon they're in the school-to-prison pipeline. So these kinds of cultural images help really perpetuate this pervasive image of people with disabilities are less valuable than others. It's called ableism. Ableism is like racism. Instead of the prejudice being about the race of the individual, it's about the ability. So it's ableism, and that is pure and simple what this film is all about.
Now, the book's author, Jojo Moyers, has said that she didn't intend it to be something that would be taken as a blanket sort of narrative for everyone who has a disability, but that she got intrigued with a particular story about a soccer player, a real-life soccer player, who decided to end his life after having an injury that paralyzed him. And so that was sort of her muse. So what do you say to that? Is that a good enough response to what you're seeing here?
Well, you know what? It is based on a real life story, and there are people with disabilities that do get despaired and they do commit suicide. That is a fact. But you don't want to glorify that with a Hollywood movie with, you know, big name sexy actors in such a way that it makes it look like that's an accepted and appropriate and welcome outcome to the disability. What you want is somebody like that to be told, hey, you've got some mental health issues that are very legitimate. let's get you some support, let's get you some therapy, and let's work through this process. But this is not what the movie does. It really glorifies the idea of this ableism, as I said.
We're talking with Jennifer Lazo-Mizrahi right now, talking about how people with disabilities are portrayed in films and in the media. She's the president of the organization Respectability. And we're starting off there talking about the release of the film Me Before You. But that's not the only film, Jennifer, that disability rights activists have taken exception with. Another is Million Dollar Baby. Here's
right.
a clip where the female boxer, played by Hilary Swank, is asking her coach, Frankie Dunn, to die, to help her die after being paralyzed after a fight.
I got it all. Don't let them keep taking it away from me. Don't let me lie here till I can't hear those people chant no more.
I can't. Please. Please don't ask me.
I'm asking.
Clip there from Million Dollar Baby. And so we're seeing kind of a pattern develop, at least in those two films. Is
right.
there enough to call it a pattern in the way that Hollywood chooses to portray people with disabilities, Jennifer?
Look, there's basically two narratives that you see pervasively throughout Hollywood, which is one is that the person with a disability is used as a prop to make other people look like heroes. So you see these storylines where, you know, a kid with a disability is allowed to play a sport and, you know, what a great hero everyone else on the team is because that kid got to play a sport just like anyone else. And it's this pity frame that really comes through. It tries to make other people look like heroes just by treating an individual with a disability as an equal, which is, you know, nobody is a hero for treating someone with a disability as an equal. People with disabilities are equal. That should be a part of how we do things. But there are some very good things happening. Interestingly, they're coming through reality television. Reality television, which a lot of people sort of poo-poo that's sort of, you know, not the highest level of entertainment, turns out that some of the greatest things are happening there. I mean, you see Niall DeMarco winning, a deaf contestant on Dancing with the Stars. It's terrific. You see Justin LeBlanc, who was a runner-up on Project Runway, who is deaf. You see now this tremendous TV show, Born This Way, which is on A&E Network, which stars seven individuals with Down syndrome, and the show is absolutely phenomenal, just won a big award in Hollywood. Again, it's Born This Way on A&E Network. It's just terrific. So interesting to see that reality television seems to be the best of all the genre coming out of Hollywood today.
And that's interesting because I guess it's a form of real life. It may be scripted and shaped in some form, but these are real people, and they're not. It's not Hollywood coming up with a storyline. Do you think that's a difference, and that Hollywood might take a cue from what's happening in reality TV?
Look, I mean, Hollywood thinks that people with disabilities are props in a storyline that makes other characters more heroic, or that it makes a story more dynamic. But reality is that people with disabilities can have tremendous abilities. I mean, you look at some of my role models with disabilities would be, for example, Richard Branson of Virgin Atlantic, who owns an airline and he has a record company and he's got, you know, a space station. Well, he has very significant learning disabilities and was not even able to finish high school, and yet he's this huge success. If you look at the company Ernst & Young, or it's called EY now, Young actually was deaf and had some vision issues, but he was incredibly good at finance, incredibly good at it, and so he started this company that now has 150,000 employees globally. So the reality of people with disabilities is that people with disabilities have abilities, but you're not seeing that in these movies.
We're talking with Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi right now, talking about how people with disabilities are portrayed in films and in the media. She's the president of the organization Respect Ability.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think the film industry could do, should do a better job with its portrayal of characters with disabilities? How could the media do a better job in portraying disabilities in reporting, in broadcast? Do you have good or bad examples in mind? And is this an issue that affects your life? Is this something that makes a difference for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about how people with disabilities are portrayed in films and the media following the release of the film Me Before You this last weekend.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. If you saw the film, if you read the novel, what were your thoughts about how it handled the main character's disability? Do you agree with the people, like our guest, who find that movie offensive and harmful? And how do you think people with disabilities should be portrayed in films, in the media, and elsewhere? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi is with us. She's president of the nonprofit Respect Ability, which advocates for people with disabilities.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Adam on the line in Kenosha. Adam, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a question for your guest. I'm curious how she feels about kind of the depression that's addressed in the movie itself. I know everybody focuses on the quadriplegic aspect of the movie, but does she think it's an important thing to take on, you know, the depression that comes with making that kind of a life adjustment, and how does she feel that can be, I guess, addressed in a positive way? As she mentioned that, you know, it kind of glorifies, you know, how depressed he is and how he thinks that ending his life is the way out. But I don't know that there's really anybody in there saying, yeah, you're right, you should end your life. I mean, how does she expect that the realism of dealing with that kind of depression should be handled in a positive way?
Great. Thank you, Adam. Appreciate that. And Jennifer, what about the main character's depression? Was it handled, do you think, if you take away the desire to end his life, how did you think the depression angle was handled in the movie?
Adam, I think that's a great question. And I want to take it to a sort of a broader place. So in Wisconsin, for example, there are literally 685,000 people with disabilities in Wisconsin, 685,000. And a lot of them have mental health disabilities. So this individual in the movie had an episodic mental health issue. Something happened. You know, disability, I always say, is the one minority group that people can join at any time due to accident, illness, or age. And that's very true. I mean, somebody who is completely able-bodied today with zero disabilities can be in a car accident or develop a disease and have this transitional period. So it's actually not just one character in a movie. It's something that is happening in Wisconsin every single day. And mental health is something that people struggle with, you know, even who didn't have an onset of a new disability, because mental health on its own can be its own disability because of, you know, bipolar disorder or schizophrenia and depression. So obviously medication and counseling can be a very, very important assistance to people who have mental health differences. And we always say that it's very important for there to be good access to those kinds of services, and that, you know, people should be shown seeking out those services and see where you can find some sort of, you know, supports and some services. But that first year on the onset of a disability is an incredibly challenging moment. And there are, frankly, for people with disabilities, there are a lot of challenging moments. You know, when parents find out for the first time that their child has a disability, that is, you know, the onset of that diagnosis, very difficult for those parents in that very first year. Another issue that you see in Wisconsin and across the country is that a lot of people who, as I said earlier, who have learning differences in particular, who don't achieve in school, wind up not finishing high school, wind up in the criminal justice system. When they first leave incarceration, what happens on their very first day? Do they, you know, get into support? Do they get access to medications if those medications were enabling them to deal with, you know, a mental health difference, for example? In a lot of cases, we find that people with disabilities are not getting access to the medication that they need to deal with these very, very significant depressions. Now, a movie is not supposed to be, you know, a documentary on how people with disabilities, you know, can deal with, you know, with every single thing. Ultimately, they're in the business of trying to tell a story that will enable them to make money because they're, you know, a part of capitalism, and entertainment for money is what they're doing. But this one is really using, you know, infotainment in a very negative way, because at the end of the story, of course, the person with a disability is killed, is you know, killed off.
Adam, thank you for that call. And we go next to Sue. Sue is joining us in Eau Claire. Sue, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a little bit different reaction to the situation Million Dollar Baby. I didn't see the primary actor as a hero in any way. I thought it was a very realistic request for the actress to make with the situation. I've worked with people with significant spinal cord injuries throughout the majority of my career. There is so many of them that really don't have the financial access. They struggle with the situations that life has dealt them. I've worked with patients who they've had the spinal cord injury, and they tried. There was one person who tried to wheel themselves onto the highway to get hit by a car so they could commit suicide, and they didn't even have the strength to do it.
Sue, thank you for sharing and telling us your perspective there. And Sue is saying, Jennifer, that this is someone who's worked with people over the years. She's seen this kind of depression in some of the people that she's worked with, an extreme story there, but maybe this is a reflection of some people's reality.
Well, the reality when you first have such an industry is it is devastating for people because you used to have a set of abilities and now you no longer have them, and it comes kind of crashing down on you. But part of it is made worse by a culture in our society that says people who are wheelchair users are somehow less valuable, less special, have less to contribute. You know, when I look at somebody like Stephen Hawking, who has very, very significant mobility issues, very significant, and I see what he contributes, I celebrate what he brings to Earth every single day that he is alive and contributing to this planet. But, you know, there's other individuals who contribute in other ways. You know, they may not be at that intellectual level, but they contribute in other ways that are equally important and special. And I'm just personally believe that everybody is very, very special and that all of us are equal and that we need to celebrate that. But people, when they look at someone in a wheelchair, they physically look down because they're standing and the person is below them, but they emotionally look down as well. And the way that people are portrayed in a film like this, it makes them look down even more on that individual.
Jennifer, as we start to wrap up, another strand of this has been people who are upset that the character, Will, was not played by someone who is disabled.
Right.
What have you heard about that?
Look, the fact is that there are a lot of people with disabilities who are incredibly good, talented actors, and they want to be cast in roles in Hollywood. And they don't get to play James Bond because they want somebody who can, you know, jump from building to building and, you know, pick up women and, you know, and do all these physical things. But they're not going to be cast for that role. Here's a role where somebody is a wheelchair user. There are talented actors who could have done that role. So yes, it really is you know, really stunning that, you know, an individual with a disability didn't have an opportunity to play that role. If you look at Breaking Bad, you have, you know, the son in it has himself not just playing someone with cerebral palsy. He actually has cerebral palsy, and I'm very, very excited about a new TV show about to come out starring Minnie Driver called Speechless. And Speechless, I think, is going to be a wonderful show coming up on ABC that shows a young person with very significant disabilities, so much so that they're not only a wheelchair user, but they don't have the ability to speak.
And we leave it there. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us. That was Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, president of Respectability, a nonprofit foundation advocating for people with disabilities. She joined us to talk about how people with disabilities are portrayed in media and film following this weekend's release of the movie Me Before You.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.